stand by for action.
Gamer's Haven Special Edition.
FRP Games at FRPGames.com is an online retailer specializing in all aspects of your tabletop gaming needs. Whether it's RPGs, dice, war games, or computer games, FRP Games has a wide selection of products. They offer overstock items where you can pick up all kinds of gaming gear ranging from 30% all the way up to 90% off the retail price. Stop by their website at FRPGames.com and check out their weekly new products, eBay auctions, or even buy your special gaming someone a gift certificate. FRP Games is an authorized Wizards of the Coast retailer and, for the last 10 years, has been committed to providing each customer with the highest standard of customer service possible. Visit them on the web at FRPGames.com or go through our website. This is Ethan with Gamers Haven Podcast, and I managed to sit down and talk with Mr. Wolfgang Bauer, who is the creator of the Kobold Quarterly magazine, as well as the Open Design project. So feel free to check out his website or check out our Amazon store for a selection of Wolfgang Bauer products, and sit back and enjoy this. Wolfgang was nice enough to take time out of his busy con schedule because he was currently at, I believe it was WonderCon, when I talked to him for the interview. So a special thanks to Wolfgang for taking some time out of his con schedule and his very busy time actually at a convention to speak to me over Skype. So thank you very much. Enjoy the interview. This is Ethan with the Gamers Haven Podcast, and I am stealing away Wolfgang Bauer from NorwestCon in Seattle, apparently, to talk to me about himself, actually. So, how are you doing, Wolfgang?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Thanks for taking the time out to talk to me. I know you're very busy with not only with convention stuff, but with other stuff as well. So,
Hey, we got a new magazine in the warehouse, off the truck today. So,
and that magazine would be
Kobold Quarterly. Absolutely.
Why don't we start with that real quick? Do the general rundown. What is Kobold Quarterly?
Well, Kobold Quarterly appears four times a year. It is a mostly a Pathfinder and 4th edition D&D magazine with occasional ventures into the Dragon Age RPG, Call of Cthulhu, and other little things. It's a nice little magazine that we get to kind of pull together all of our best and favorite bits from all over the industry, really.
And how long have you been publishing that one?
Can you believe it? This is issue 13, so 13. I guess that means 3 years.
Wow. I was gonna say it seemed like it was about 3 or 4 years now. So.
Yeah. I didn't think it would last that long. And honestly, I never even thought it would survive in print, but it's doing fine. There are subscribers for print and PDF, and people keep writing in saying, wow, it's the letters I love are the ones that write in and say, you know, I saw a copy in the hobby store and it looks so much better than I expected. Not sure how to take that.
It's always good.
Yeah, it's like, thanks, I think.
Well, I have a question I ask everyone I talk to. And this is a series of interviews I've been doing, and your interview number 9. So,
okay.
How did you get into the gaming hobby? Not necessarily the industry, but what got you first rolling the dice?
Ooh, that was easy. I went down to the local hobby store, and I don't even remember why. But, you know, I went to the hobby store, and there was this blue box with a red dragon and a wizard and a fighter. And I said, it must be mine. But I was like 12, 11, something like that. I had no money. I read the back cover and I said, I can be a hero. I can slay orcs. This is perfect. And I begged and pleaded. And I think my parents got it for me for Christmas, birthday. And that was it. I was lost. I was off and running.
You were doomed from that point on.
Absolutely. I saw that picture I think it's a Dave Sutherland painting.
I think you're right.
Yeah, and you know, it's not the snazziest art I've ever seen, but it really conveyed what it was all about.
And moving on from that is, you of course are now in the industry itself. How did you start off getting into the industry as professionally?
Well, I followed a well-trodden path, which is called pure dumb luck. No, actually, it's not as purely lucky as that. I started writing for Dungeon Magazine, as a matter of fact, when I was still in high school. Mm-hmm. And I had to get, you know, parental waivers on the contracts, that sort of thing. Mom, Dad, I wrote something for a magazine. Can I sign away my rights? Sure, son, here you go. That was great. And it was a thrill to see, you know, my name in print, and hey, I did this adventure, and now they like this article. But I kind of thought of it as just a way to bring in a few bucks to buy more gaming stuff. I didn't think of it as my break into the industry at the time. So I kept doing that through college. I wrote a little for Iron Crown, some more for TSR, and somewhere in grad school, my teaching assistantship ran out. The money ran out.
Oops.
And my department had called me and he said, "I'm really sorry, this is purely temporary, but we don't have a position for you this semester. Come back next semester. Just, you know, go home." He didn't say go live in your parents' basement, but that's sort of what I sort of got out. Yeah. Well, I didn't want to live in my parents' basement, and a buddy of mine said, "Well, you know, TSR is hiring editors." And I didn't know, so word of mouth was everything. And I wrote to the editor. They'd seen my manuscripts over the years, and they said, "Well, can you come out?" Sure. Me go to Lake Geneva? Yeah, I think so. And I got through the interview. They hired me, and, you know, that department head was disappointed. About 6 months later, I had to call him up and say, "I'm having a really great time here at this little company in Lake Geneva. I'm not coming back."
And so those are your early days in, I'm assuming that was TSR.
That was at TSR, absolutely. TSR. And I worked with Barbara Young and Roger Moore, and Zeb Cook was there. It was second edition. It was crazy times.
From what I understand, you worked on, amongst other things, Birthright, Planescape, and Al-Qadim. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, Al-Qadim. I worked on all of those. I worked on a whole lot of issues of Dungeon and Dragon. There were a few other things in there. I worked on some monster manuals. Mm-hmm. People tended to pick up whatever was around.
It would be my co-host, Jeremy, would probably issue me a summary beatdown if I didn't ask you what you worked on for Birthright, as that is his favorite thing in the universe.
Oh, I didn't work on one of the best parts of Birthright. That core box is awesome. And Rich Baker's home campaign translated into a fantastically, I think it's just a really well-designed setting. I just wrote an adventure for it called Sword of Roel. It's okay. It's not a bad adventure, but I don't look back on it and say, "Yeah, I shaped Birthright with that thing."
Well, you eventually went on at TSR, and TSR got bought out by Wizards of the Coast. What can you tell us about that that experience?
Well, I didn't actually get that experience. I had jumped ship by then. I really had. The timing for me was fortuitous. I was editor of Dragon Magazine at the time. I heard that there was an awful lot going on in Seattle, these Wizards of the Coast kids with their magic game. Mm-hmm. I was all too aware of their success, and then I had an opportunity to go interview with them. They said, "Would you like to come out? Would you like to work for us?" And Jonathan Tweet hired me to work on role-playing games at Wizards of the Coast. And, it was sort of hard to say no.
Sure.
So I gave up a really nice gig as editor of Dragon Magazine, mm-hmm. job I loved.
What was it like as editor of Dragon Magazine, working your way up from, you know, getting your parents to sign off on submissions for it?
Well, you know, I started as the junior assistant flunky. Uh-huh. It's like, here, you get to all the sort of rattiest columns that come in, and you read the slush pile and sure. go do these contracts. But it was really an education, both in how to edit and how to be a professional editor, and how to think about game design and what's going to work for an audience. Because every month we had to put forward something that people were going to love. Mm-hmm. And you could see it in the subscription numbers if they hated it, right? So sure. It was really about connecting with the audience. And the periodicals department was down the hall from the game designers at TSR, down a long hall, and there was a mapping department in between. So, you know, we didn't totally communicate that much, except over lunch. And so I guess what I learned is pay attention to your audience and, you know, listen to your readers, which is something that the pure game designers had to worry about less. They were insulated from the people mm-hmm. who bought the core rule books in a way that the periodical staff wasn't really insulated.
Right.
I mean, it's not good or bad. It's just two different approaches to how do you make games.
Mm-hmm. And so you were at WotC and transitioned over to when WotC bought TSR. So you were at the WotC end at that point.
Yeah, I was at the WotC end at that time, and all of my friends were moved out, and suddenly there was my social circle. Hey, coming to visit me in Seattle. It's like, all my old buddies, hooray. They all asked me where to rent an apartment and
sure.
where's the DMV. I was the scout. So, yeah, I got to tell them a little bit about how the company worked, but it was changing so rapidly at that point. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I was more than a couple of months ahead of the curve. Sure. But yeah, they came out, and then I got to work with all of them again. Mm-hmm. Which was good.
And while at WotC, you did Dark Matter, wasn't that right?
Yes, that was sort of the crowning moment of my WotC career. There were a lot of projects I worked on in the card space, in role-playing, but that's the one that has really stuck, and it even got a reprint because it was originally done using the Alternity rule set, and it was right. reprinted with the D20 Modern. So, yeah.
And you'll have to forgive me. I know it's Dark Matter was for Alternity. And the reason it sort of sticks in my mind is it came out, or it might have been Alternity that came out, at the first Gen Con I went to.
Oh, okay.
And so, what can you tell me about Dark Matter? Because I was a bit naive at the time and didn't look at it.
Sure. Well, at the time, we were trying to shamelessly rip off the X-Files. I guess if it had been written 5 years later, everyone would have said, you're shamelessly ripping off Dan Brown or something, right?
Right.
But it's in that conspiracy, horror, secret society genre, and it meant that the research for it was a complete, endless rat hole, right?
Right.
Our assumption was, all those conspiracy theories you've heard about, they're all true. Mm-hmm. and the only thing... Well, yeah. Well, especially the ones that contradict each other was an interesting design challenge. But
yeah.
We picked our favorites and we sort of munged them around to fit the Alternity core races. And basically said, okay, there are secret masters behind the scenes, and you, as an agent of the Hoffman Institute, are defending humanity against that. Good luck. Here's your 357 and a badge. Good luck. It was just delightful to set plot hooks like, you know, Nazis and Templars. And
oh, hey, beating up Nazis is always fun.
Yeah, I made the argument to Monty at the time that the game is set here in the 90s. It's in the now. You know, most of the Nazis probably died 30 years ago. There's not a lot of Nazis left. And his counter argument was, no, you've got to have Nazis. And I sort of said, yeah, Yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah, really, as hard as one thinks about it, there's nothing wrong with beating up Nazis. So
no, there really isn't. And, you know, by the time I'd wrapped my brain around, well, the Yetis really are not that far. Sasquatch is up in the hills near Seattle. There are lizard men under the mountains in California, you know, saying, the Nazis all live to be 120 years old and they have a secret base on the moon. Fine. That's not a stretch.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, that was a lot of fun. I think the fact that we had fun with it really shows in the writing. I think the alternative rule set was actually a very good match for it. And people like that setting. So I'm glad I still hear from fans.
Nice.
Now, the while you were at, after you were at WotC, you now correct me if I'm wrong. Did you go freelance after that? After working
pretty much. WotC? Yep, I said that's enough. I'm done with the WotC system. I am striking out on my own, and that was an education as well. Because, you know, all those freelancers whom I envied while I sat in my corporate offices, as it turns out, they were busting their butts just to keep mac and cheese on the table. And I quickly saw that. But yeah, I've had some success as a freelancer. I've had a pretty good time. And
most notably, your work with Open Design.
Yeah, well, with Paizo before then, but yes, Open Design for the last 3 or 4 years now, the patronage model has been doing rather well, doing collaborative design with basically anybody who wants to show up, thus the name Open Design.
Right.
Throw some money in the kitty to pay for art and maps, and we will write this thing up, right? And I've totally derailed my train of thought. Yeah, so, I mean, basically, anybody who shows up can be a game designer, or at least watch the game design process, vote on the things they like, say, hey, you missed something in the mechanics, hey, you missed something in the plot for this adventure, or the best thing of all is what the patrons say, I'd love to hear this, hey, wouldn't it be cool if, and you just know, right, it's always me and 100 patrons supporting the project. And,
sure.
You know, some people say I do a pretty good job, but it's just me. 100 other people are always going to outthink me. So 100 people throwing good ideas into the kitty means we've written some outstanding adventures. We've playtested them thoroughly. And we've just put them through the ringer. So what comes out the other end is a little better than average.
Sure.
Well, okay, a lot better than average. They keep handing us awards.
Well, that's good.
Hey, yeah, Diana Jones.
As long as they're giving them away, you know, hey.
Absolutely. A bunch of Ennies. No, it's been very successful, both creatively and critically. I won't say financially because it really is still...
Sure.
Throw some money in the kitty. If I count the hours, I will cry. But that's not the point, right? It's
one of the things I've noticed is talking, like I said, you're the ninth interview I've done, is talking to a lot of freelancers and industry people is you really don't get into the gaming industry to make money. You do it because you love it.
Yeah, if you're in it to make money, boy, boy, are you in for a disappointment.
You're in the wrong industry.
Yeah, go be a banker or a lawyer or a doctor. Those people make money. But game designers generally don't, at least not tabletop game designers. I suspect if you talk to the guys at Blizzard, they do okay.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, we won't get into the whole Activision thing. Yet.
No, that's just a flame war waiting to happen.
Yeah, exactly. What can you tell me about the Free City of Zobek?
It was invented because I didn't own any worlds at that point. The very first Open Design project needed to be set somewhere, right?
Right.
Writing the opening background. You're sitting in the Hedgehog Tavern on College Square in the... I can't write Free City of Greyhawk. Free City of Sobek sounds good. You know, that's literally what happened. I just needed a name. And then, well, the first one was a city adventure, so I had to get some characters and figure out a system of government and, you know, make all these world-building design decisions that weren't purely part of the adventure. But I said, okay, we'll just go with this for now. And I tried to make it general enough that anybody could drop it in. If they wanted to swap this adventure into Greyhawk, no problem. If they wanted to put it in Eberron and Sharn, hey, that's easy. So it started that way, but then it started to acquire its own character. It's inevitable, right? We set the second adventure there, and then we've done 8 open designs. We're on number 9. The place has grown. And now people ask me for the supplements and the map and what's the rest of the world look like around it. That was never the intention. The intention was it's going to be so generic, you just plop it in your campaign.
Right.
And I I don't know. Remember what I said about all those people saying, wouldn't it be cool if?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, we've been saying that about Sobek a lot, and it's gotten to be a very interesting place. Yeah, I could tell you the history and how the nobles all got strung up and the Arcane Collegium and all its secrets and the fact that there's an entire ghetto full of kobolds that live in one quarter of the city. And it gives you some sense of how off the beaten track it's become.
How many open design projects have you done now?
Well, I haven't done...
I kind of lost count.
Yeah, I sort of have lost count too, because some of them count double, like Halls of the Mountain King, right. 188 pages of Dwarven Adventure done in 2 editions.
Wow.
So, you know, do you count the 3rd edition and the 4th edition ones separately? Or is it the same thing, but there was just a whole lot of redesign of the statistics and right. the maps and, yeah.
And you've done writing for 2nd, 3rd, and 4th edition, right?
I have.
Which
is odd.
Yeah, which one do you like writing for the best?
It was a lot easier to write for 2nd edition. You could just make shit up. Oh, wait. You said not which was easiest. You said which do I like best. You know, the rules got a lot tighter around 3rd edition, and that was both good and bad. And the way that the mechanics have fractured the experience, the design experience at least, for player source books versus DM monster setting material and 4th, that's pretty appealing too. They all have things I like about designing for them, but... Mm-hmm. I don't know. What we put on the cover of the most recent issue of Kobold Quarterly is the Switzerland of the edition wars. So I don't know that I want to commit to a preference. I'll play them all. I'll still play 2nd edition.
Yeah, that's something we talk about is just we live in an interesting time now where you have two different versions of D&D that are actively being published. So
I think it's
a great time to be a D&D player.
Oh, absolutely. You've got settings galore, you've got great adventures, you've got supplements and material, and you've got more than a couple of companies, you know, slugging it out for your gaming dollar, mm-hmm. doing their best.
Well, yeah. It's
Okay.
Who cares which edition that you play, as long as you play, you know?
Yeah. I think most of the edition wars have kind of died down, and people are, for the most part, in a live and let live kind of mode.
Is there anything coming up that we should be excited about or that you're excited about?
Well, other than the latest issue of the magazine, which I'm pretty excited about, there's also an open design source book that's coming out. This one's a Pathfinder book, and I didn't write it, but I'm still really excited about it. It's called Sunken Empires, and yeah, the creative direction or creative brief for it was, okay, we're going to sink Atlantis and find out everything cool about sunken empires and lost technology and what's under the sea and, you know, building net fighters, like, and new spells and new oceanic bloodlines. And this is the part that gets me really excited. We're going to get the man who invented the Aboleth, Zeb Cook, to write us up. What were you thinking, Zeb, when you invented a three-eyed fishman with tentacles? And he answers that question in the book and talks about the history of the Aboleth. So it's squiddly, it's fishy, it's good fun.
When can we expect that one?
That will be shipping in April. That's out in a few weeks. Yes. It is available for pre-order now.
I'm going to have to look into that one. That sounds pretty good. Now, the open design stuff is not available through stores. You have to
this one is.
Oh, this one is? Okay.
This one is, and actually our next fourth edition one, which I am writing, that one will be in stores as well. But they're harder to find. We only have one big hobby game store distributor.
But if you have a good friendly local game store, they'll try to track it down for you.
They'll track it down. It's certainly possible. You can get it through Alliance or IPR or those sorts of places. But you got to try a little harder. We don't have the distribution of Wizards or Paizo or White Wolf.
Yeah, but that's fine.
We're little gems hidden away.
And you are at a convention right now, so presumably one would hope that you've actually had a chance to roll some dice lately.
Yes, although not as much as I would like. There's a lot of schmoozing in the bar. There's a lot of panels. The halls are crowded, but they have an excellent gaming track at NorwestCon. The last 2 years now, they suddenly realized that they were, you know, surrounded by gamers. Mm-hmm. This is an old science fiction convention from way back. This is NorwestCon 33 this year. So, yeah, they've been going for a while, but at some point they said, let the gamers in.
Yeah, I live out in Kansas City, which is very devoid of any kind of gaming conventions and whatnot. So
you need to drive up to St. Louis or something? I don't know.
that would be the sane thing to do, but what I just started doing is organizing my own gaming convention. So
woohoo! Good for you.
And you guys actually sent us stuff for last year. It was CantCon.
Oh, that's right, right.
Last August, we've out.
And are you doing it again?
Yes. Well, we were doing it in one of our host's residences. Had about 30 people show up. You know,
that's good for a first year.
Now we've got about 100 people showing up, so I've had to actually go out and get a venue and get insurance and all that crazy stuff. So
yeah, see, now you're learning what is it that con organizers do.
So yeah, that's been going on around here a lot.
That's great. I always love to hear.
Got local community college is graciously letting us use their facilities, so we're very happy with that. So yes, organizing that has been a chore.
Yeah. Hey, I know. I've seen people do it and do it well, but it's never easy.
But you know, I got sick of waiting for someone else to do it, so I was like, fine, we'll just do it here.
Yeah. Good. Bravo.
But luckily, I'll be able to go to Gen Con this year. I was unable to go last year, which is what CantCon came out of. So
I did not make it there last year either. And this year, Cobalt Quarterly is going to be there. We're going to have all our open design goodies. We're going to have some panels and some things that will only be for Gen Con. It's going
to
be fun.
I'll have to try to track you down and say hi.
Sure. Booth 2439. I'm enabling your stalking.
Excellent. Well, that's enabling stalking. That's not necessarily a good thing.
Oh, probably not. Oh, no, they'll know where to find me.
I've got one last question to ask you.
Okay.
One thing that the Gamers Haven does is we're not only are we a podcast, we're also now a social club. So.
Excellent.
And fully recognized by the IRS, I might add.
Ooh, very good.
But one thing we like to do is basically we do this because we love gaming, and tabletop gaming is a great hobby. And everyone has an interesting answer usually. What is it about the tabletop gaming hobby that you love? Why do you keep doing all this?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons. In terms of just playing, it's fun, right? I've known some of these people for 10 years or more, and I'm happy to keep playing with them. In terms of writing for it, designing for it, honestly, it's a creative outlet that I don't think is quite like anything else, right? You can just leap in, do your thing, strut your stuff in front of people and say, hey, look at this. And, you know, maybe it's the Luddite in me. It's just no longer possible to do that in, say, video games or many other forms of entertainment, film. And so there's a do-it-yourself attitude that I really like. This is what I admire about the Green Ronin guys, right?
Right.
They pretty much have the punk rock attitude of, okay, Dragon Age, you're a video game, great. We're going to get the license. We're going to make the tabletop version. You know, you can't stop us. That's literally the attitude, right? It's like, we're going to go out and do this because we think it's great. Even the big companies show this attitude when, like, WotC says, you know what? It's time to do Gamma World again. My first reaction was, what?
Yeah.
And my second reaction was, oh yeah, okay, they can do that, sure. it's their world, and it's been a while since we've seen anything about it. So, you know, you don't need $1 million special effects budget to have a good time on the tabletop.
And that's what's great about, that's what's great about the hobby, I think, is, you know, each experience is a new experience.
Yeah. I mean,
even if it's the same game, you know.
Exactly. If you have a strong imagination, if you have a good rapport with your players or your DM, if you have somebody who likes to crack jokes, well, of course you want to spend time with those people. It's fun. It's entertaining. And it's, again, doesn't require a loan from the bank. It's a cheap hobby, too, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so, lots of reasons to love it.
I know you got to run, so I want to thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to talk to me. So, thank you.
You dropped out.
Did I drop out?
I lost you for a second there. Sorry.
No problem. I just want to thank you for taking the time out to talk to me from your con schedule and whatnot. So,
sure. Hey, my next panel's in 20 minutes.
Excellent. I will let you go and, you know, have some fun at a convention. So,
I can do that.
I'll go back.
Thanks for having me on.
Working on mine. So,
good luck with your con, and I'll see you in Indianapolis.
Take care, Wolfgang. Bye.
All right. Bye bye.
Gamers Haven Podcast is proud to present Pathfinder, The Revenge of Westwind Falls. 50 years ago, the dwarven keep of Westwind Falls was attacked. A small group of dwarves were the only known survivors. Now that they're all grown up, it's time for them to find out who destroyed their ancestral home and get revenge for Westwind Falls. Available for download only at www.gamershavenpodcast.com. Been listening to the Gamers Haven Podcast. Subscribe to the show by visiting our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, where you can also discuss all things gaming in our forum, drop us an email, or just peruse our episode archives. You can also call us toll-free and leave a message to be played on the show by dialing 1-877-416-1270. That's toll-free 877-416-1270. On our website, you'll also find our actual play podcasts chronicling our misadventures through all things role-playing. Enjoy what you hear? Why not support the Gamers Haven by purchasing Gamers Haven merchandise, visiting our affiliates, or just by clicking on our donate button? The Gamers Haven Podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 United States License, Some Rights Reserved, Some music in this podcast is used with permission of Joe Hero Band at joehero.com. This is a Thousand Monkeys production.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.